You're listening to a People of Note podcast, as heard on Classic 1027.
Good evening and welcome to People of Note on Classic 1027. I'm Richard Koch, and this program is broadcast every Sunday from 6 to 8. In it, I talk to someone who is a person of note, and we listen to music of their choice. And I'm very happy to tell you that my guest tonight is Peter Bruce, and I'll tell you about him in a moment, or he'll tell you about him himself. Good evening.
Good evening, Richard. Lovely to be with you, and thank you so much for asking me to do this. It's been an extremely difficult and emotional few days putting a list together for you. The cutting floor is a real mess.
Well, where is the cutting floor? Tell us where you are.
Right. My wife, Robin, and I moved from Johannesburg to Stanford, which is a very, very small village, sort of roughly midway between Hermanus and Hans Bay. Not on the sea, slightly inland. We're protected from those horrible coastal winds that seem to blow constantly down here. It's a very quiet, well-run little village. Like all other parts of South Africa, suffering quietly under the COVID epidemic and the lockdowns, but a very resilient little town, and we're very proud of it. Where we can, we contribute to efforts to help less fortunate people than ourselves. I think the town is currently making something like 2,000 meals a day for people, which is quite extraordinary, given that in fact most of the houses in town are occupied sort of only at weekends or holidays. So Stanford is over 100 years old. It was founded as a farm originally by a chap who used to supply groceries to the British authorities in Cape Town. And he was doing very well. He became Sir Robert Stanford, and then got himself into terrible trouble because a shipload of convicts from England being sent out to Australia were forced to pull into Cape Town Harbour, Table Bay. And the local population didn't want anything to do with them, and they wanted the ship removed and to sail on. And they desperately needed supplies and something healthy to eat. And the governor, who I think was Harry Smith, turned to Robert Stanford and asked him whether he could supply from his farm. And there's a place not far from Hans Bay called Stanford's Cove, and he used to then ferry out supplies to ships, which is what he did in this case, supplied the convicts on board the Australia-bound vessel, and was from then on, Cape Town turned its back on him and ostracized him, and he died in terrible financial straits, and I think I had to go back to England, and it was all a terrible, terrible mess. But he left behind him the beginnings of a lovely little village.
And obviously quite a well-knit community.
It has become, you know, all communities build themselves around activists and leaders. So there are a few people in the town who really do, you know, roll up their sleeves and get things done, and we're all immensely grateful to them for doing that. There's very, very little tension in the town, and I think people have got the politics right. You know, in a small town, these things can get out of hand, and it doesn't happen in Stanford, not that I've seen anyway.
Well, yeah, because there certainly has been some tension a little way along the coast at Hermanus in the past. But one of the stories of People of Note is that we listen to music of your choice. And perhaps if we listen to your first piece of music, which is Ray Conniff, Love is a Many Splendid Thing, you can tell us a bit about where you came from originally. But let's listen to some music. Now, this is Ray Conniff, Love is a Many Splendid Thing. That was Ray Conniff performing Love is a Many Splendid Thing, the choice of Peter Bruce, who's my guest in People of Note. Peter, perhaps before we hear about your earlier origins, perhaps you can just tell our listeners who you are and what you are.
I'm the son of a building contractor who became a failed architectural student after matriculating. And after failing to become an architect, I fell into journalism. I was in Durban at the University of Natal. And my sister was married to a very well-known journalist called Donald Woods, my sister Wendy. And Donald was one of my early and consistent sort of life heroes, and I missed him desperately now that he's been gone all these years. But I decided that I would apply to become a journalist. So I dropped out of university, lay down on my bed at my digs in Durban, and it was round about the time that all the President's Men had come out, and you'd seen these wonderful pictures, wonderful movie about how, you know, two enterprising journalists brought down a pretty toxic president in Richard Nixon. And I was full of, you know, enthusiasm for reporting and journalism, and I got a job. There was a knock at my door one day, and there was a reporter there saying, I can't remember her name, and she said, the news editor, Godfrey King, would like to meet you. So I went down, and I got a job as a sort of beat reporter doing routine things. I had to drive around Durban every morning in the company VW with a radio and collect the statistics of the night before from hospitals and fire stations and morgues and the harbor. And they would go into a daily report for the Mercury. But I'd grown up in Mtata. My dad was a building contractor in Mtata. His father before him was a building contractor in Mtata. His grandfather was a wheelwright in Butterworth in Transkei. I went to Mtata High School, and my parents were prosperous. You know, they weren't the only builders in town, but he was it was the biggest firm. And they were both very musical. Both my parents played the piano extremely well. My father particularly could play anything. And so the house was always full of the latest music. Some, you know, it was old fashioned. I didn't realize that at the time. I thought it was all fascinating. And the Ray Conniff that you've just heard, I can almost see the sleeve of the album. It was in a big Blaupunkt radio come turntable come record stand that was the sort of main feature of the lounge, as we used to call it then. And my mum absolutely loved all the Ray Conniffs and the Trini Lopez and all of those sort of hip people of the time, and she would play them a lot.
Yeah. Well, I remember, I think we were of a similar vintage, and my mother was a great lover of Ray Conniff also, and Julius Katchen was another one. I seem to remember the LPs or records of Julius Katchen.
Yeah.
But obviously you were beginning to build a different sort of dream while you were in Durban, but one of the pieces that you've associated with your home in Mtata is Louis Armstrong, A Kiss to Build a Dream On. That was Louis Armstrong, the famous piece, A Kiss to Build a Dream On, the choice of Peter Bruce, who's my guest in People of Note, and he was talking about his early life in Mtata. But then having failed at, well, not failed, but having given up on architecture, you then started as a sort of, what I suppose we'd call it, a cub reporter, would we?
Yeah, so I mean, just to finish the Kiss to Build a Dream On was something I clearly remember my father playing on both the piano and his newly acquired Lowry organ. We didn't quite stretch to a Hammond, but the Lowry was very good. But what happened was that, you know, my dad Harold wanted me to follow in his footsteps in the company, in the family business, and in as a building contractor. And I tried my best and I failed, basically. I mean, I was no good at maths required for architecture, and I tried my hand at quantity surveying and didn't do very well at that either. So, yes, I spent a year in 1974 at the Mercury, and then I, through both the intervention of my brother-in-law, Donald Woods, and my dad, they persuaded, and myself really, they persuaded me to go back and get a degree, anything really. So I went to Grahamstown to Rhodes and did a degree, which was new in those days, in journalism, which I don't really advise people to do anymore these days. I think far better to do English or history, or, you know, broaden yourself a little bit. I got it and I had great fun, and university sort of changed my life in a way, and it opened my eyes to what was happening in the country. And yeah, it was a very important period for me. And I would, we'll talk a little bit more about it, but it's, you know, my lifelong friends were made at university, yeah. Not schools somehow.
And it's interesting that you moved from what must have been a small community in Umtata to a small community in Grahamstown, and now you've sort of gone back to your roots by moving to a small community in Stanford.
Yeah, it is a weird thing. I actually love big cities. I lived in London for a long time. I lived in Madrid for a very long time as a correspondent for the Financial Times. When I worked in West Germany for the Financial Times, I lived in literally what John le Carré called a small town in Germany, which was Bonn on the Rhine. So, you know, I think what you do in any place is you carve out your place in it, and that's where you live. In Johannesburg, I was, you know, I basically lived between my house and the Parkview Shopping Center. And in Germany, you can, you know, you have your Stammkneipe, your pub that you always go to. And I had mine. It was called Gambrinos, I remember. So, yeah, I mean, I do like, I'm a creature of habit. And although I might like to know that I'm in a big city, I would tend to use only a very small part of it.
Now, so a lot of your early choices of music are people like Scott Joplin or Nat King Cole, and your next choice is actually Nat King Cole, one of the great voices, The Very Thought of You. That was the wonderful voice of Nat King Cole, The Very Thought of You, the choice of Peter Bruce, who's my guest in People of Note. And I see coming up, did you, by the way, ever play a musical instrument?
No, well, this is my last great regret, you know. So I lived and grew up around people who played the piano, and my grandfather played the trumpet extremely well and the piano. My grandmother, my mother's mother, also played the piano. And I took lessons, and I'm afraid it was just too much for me. I don't know. I can't remember whether it was being teased for doing something that was a sort of sissy thing to do, or whether I just didn't like the piano teacher. But I didn't. I just couldn't play.
Click.
I was uncoordinated. It was difficult for me to play chords with my left hand and it was tunes with my right. I never got it. And it made me miserable.
But maybe you played rugby or something. I mean, you're quite a big guy, I seem to remember.
Yeah. I played sport at school. I mean, you were in terrible trouble if you didn't. I played first team rugby and first team cricket on and off, and tennis and athletics and all of those sorts of things. So I had a very happy childhood in Umtata. And, you know, the Nat King Cole, once again, just very redolent of my home and the sounds that I would hear when I walked into the house from school or from a, you know, an afternoon's play outside. Yeah. The Blaupunkt radio did sterling service for almost my entire childhood, actually. Yeah.
But obviously you were quite close to your sister, Wendy, also, and she was quite a good pianist.
Wendy was a fabulous pianist and she played concerts on occasion, and she played with a guy who you may have heard called Bruce Gardner.
Yes, definitely.
And they were very good friends, and Bruce lived in East London. Is still alive. He played at a memorial for my dad when he died 2 years ago. And it was just amazing to see him and amazing to to listen to him, and very emotional.
Yeah.
But Wendy was older than I was, and she was 10 years, 11 years older than I was, and she and Donald courted for a while and then got married and moved to East London, and he was about to go on to this great career. And, of course, we all know that, you know, he ended up befriending Steve Biko, and that led to a great friendship and a movie and books and the departure, ultimately, very sadly, of Donald and his entire family from South Africa after Steve was killed in custody by the police. But the house in East London during that time, and you know, I can Steve, just a quick word about him. He was like I don't know what the word he was like, a ghost almost. He would just appear in doorways, and I clearly remember him once appearing in under an archway in the Woods house. And it, I'm sure Wendy wasn't playing the song that we are going to play right now when he did, but he became a fixture in the house. Well, I'm sure he only, you know, used it when he needed to, but it was a wonderful time to be alive in a way, because I was discovering so many things and so many people that I didn't know. And I certainly know that Wendy and Donald were as well.
And here's a piece to remind you of that time. This is The Maple Leaf Rag by Scott Joplin. That was the famous Maple Leaf Rag by Scott Joplin, the choice of Peter Bruce, my guest on People of Note. And we were talking about Steve Biko and those times when he was, Donald Woods was editor of the Daily Dispatch, I seem to remember.
That's right, yeah. Part of the reason that I wanted to become a journalist is that Donald seemed to lead an entirely charmed life. You know, he played golf very well. He played the piano brilliantly. He was an absolutely excellent chess player. The only thing he did wrong was smoke too much, and he smoked an enormous amount of cigarettes. But he, you know, you'd come home and either sit down and, well, Wendy mainly was the great lover, as I recall, of ragtime. And it was she, I think, who found Scott Joplin first, and she could play all of the rags that he composed. And he was, I don't know whether you like the ragtime stuff, but it's absolutely wonderful. And I know that I'm speaking to the, you know, the top conductor in the country when talking to you. So you may already have had the pleasure of conducting a piece of ragtime, but I can't imagine that it's very easy. It seems to be an incredibly complex and complicated and joyful thing, certainly to play, and joyful thing to listen to.
Yeah. Funny enough, we do have an orchestral version of The Entertainer, which we play fairly regularly. And it's not difficult to play, funny enough. Those rhythms are very distinctive, and the musicians all know them, so they latch onto them quite quickly. But another of the pieces that's come up that you've chosen because of Donald and Wendy was Rhapsody in Blue.
Well, the Gershwin was the great, you know, George Gershwin was, I think, the Wendy's greatest gift to me. I mean, or their greatest gift to me, just introducing me to that song. It still moves me. I cannot, if I hear the beginning of Rhapsody in Blue, I stand still and listen to the whole thing. I absolutely love this music. And I don't know how, you know, I can't imagine what it would be like to even conceive of something like that. What genius is it that creates this in your mind?
Yeah. Well, and I won't tell you the story of how it all happened. Well, you may know the story of how it began, but it's quite a long story about seeing a notice in the newspaper about the concert about to happen. And so it was written at white heat and great speed.
Good God.
Yeah, but the version that you wanted to hear was featuring Leonard Bernstein. Also, we can't play the whole thing because it's a bit long, but here is a part. Here's a part of Rhapsody in Blue by Leonard Bernstein.
What I like, he played the piano and conducted the orchestra, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, yeah. And that's the version we've got here. It's just a part of it. Here it comes. That was part of Rhapsody in Blue, a recording made in 1976 by Leonard Bernstein, probably with the New York Philharmonic, I would think. But that's about the time, 76, when you were, what, in London, I guess?
Well, no, 76, to be exact, was you know, the year of the great uprising in Soweto and of the youth and led to Steve's eventual death and Donald's escape from the country, the children and Wendy following him to London. I got to London in 1978 only. And by then, you know, life was a bit more complicated. It was interesting. I had to find a job. I was living with Wendy and Donald and the five children at the time, and I had to go out and find work. And I started sub-editing on weekly newspapers in North London, the North London Weekly Herald. I'll never forget it. And created a sort of a line for about a dozen other South Africans to come through and on their way to Fleet Street. I then started getting shifts on what was called the Evening News, which no longer exists, but it was one of two evening papers in London, and it had 17 editions a day, and we had to start work at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was quite an extraordinary experience for me as a journalist in terms of accuracy and speed, and just how demanding, you know, the newspaper work was, as opposed to, say, working online or writing for the internet now. I mean, I would be given a story of maybe 1,000 words written by some hardworking reporter, and I'd be told by the production editor or the chief sub-editor sitting at the top of the table to make a 17-word photo caption out of it, and I'd be given the photograph as well. So that was really demanding, because if he didn't like the caption, he didn't only tell you, but he told the whole floor. It was a rough and tumble, and it taught me, you know, it toughened you up for what was to come, because print journalism was and remains, it's rather like Test cricket, you know, it's the purest form of it in my view. And it's much more demanding than, you know, the one-day game or whatever one might like to call the internet.
Yeah. Well, and maybe we should just talk about that for a moment, because you've seen the sort of rise and, not the rise and fall, but the rise and demise, if you like, of print media. Newspapers are just a shadow of what they used to be.
Certainly, South African newspapers are, and it's a real pity, and that's largely, I'm afraid, because the owners have let them become so. If you look at the New York Times or the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, The Times in London, they are robust and strong print products, and that was because their owners quickly decided to put them behind paywalls and not give their content away for free, which is what has happened in this country.
Yeah.
And once you've given something away for free once, it's very hard to start charging for it. And largely because of that, they've run out of revenue, you know, and the revenues just aren't there any longer to support the kind of staff you need to produce a quality newspaper. And it's a terrible shame. I'm glad I'm not in Joburg, because the newspapers arrive here late, if they arrive at all in Stanford. And quite frankly, I'm happier not to see them.
Yeah.
I mean, I did think at one stage that I could not get out of bed without having first held some newsprint in my hands, but I can actually.
Yeah.
And I try to forget it, and then I'm always sort of pulled back by a copy of something I pick up.
You're still writing for various publications.
Yes, I mean, I'm very grateful to them. I mean, I write a column for the Sunday Times every week. I write a column for Business Day. I was editor of Business Day for 14 years, and I've been writing a column for the Financial Mail, which I was also editor of, and that was for about 4 years. But I've just changed the column for the Financial Mail to a podcast, rather like this, although there's no music attached to it. And I'm really enjoying it because you've got all sort of people to help you. You know, you get to have a great conversation with somebody.
Yeah.
And somebody else, you know, somebody else makes it sound fantastic and puts music in and tops and tails it. And it takes much less time and is much more fun. But yeah, I'm still writing. I'm still enjoying it. There's a lot to write about. There's a lot of, you can see so many trains coming down so many tunnels in South Africa that I would be very, very hard pressed not to, you know, write about. Well, I'd be very hard pressed to ignore them. Put it that way. There's so much going wrong here. And one wants to be able to point it out, and you just got to try and do it in a way that's constructive. And by constructive, I mean so that you actually have some impact. It's all very well shouting the odds and calling people names and makes people feel good who might be on the other side. But if you want the government to behave differently, you've got to approach them, you know, in a certain way.
So you're still rolling along, which is good. And your next choice, in fact, is the Rolling Stones. And this is called Start Me Up. That was the Rolling Stones with Start Me Up, the choice of Peter Bruce, my guest in People of Note tonight. That's the program you're listening to on Classic 1027. I'm Richard Koch. And you can listen to these programs on podcasts from the Monday after their broadcast. If you just go to our website, www.classic1027.co.za, you can just follow the prompts and you will find them all there, from past ones as well. And tonight I'm talking to Peter Bruce, who started life in Umtata, worked on the Mercury in Durban, and then went up to Johannesburg and started to East London first, and then to Johannesburg and worked on the Financial Mail and various places abroad as well. And you mentioned Bonn and Madrid. You spent a lot of time in Madrid, you said.
Well, I spent 7 years in Madrid and 4 years in Bonn. The Financial Times was very generous with its postings, and that it was a form of diplomatic service, really. So you get posted to. I was posted to Bonn in 1984, and you know we were ridiculously spoiled. I was able to rent a penthouse on the Rhine, on the other side of Bonn, looking at Bonn, which was a beautiful city. It wasn't bombed during the war like Cologne, which is just up the river, and I could sit out on my penthouse deck and watch, you know, all of the sort of shipping go by. There was a very large barge, I remember, that used to come past called Pierre Bruce, which I adopted. But it was a very good time for me, and Bonn I really, really loved. And you know, you have to obviously learn the language when you go to these foreign countries, and that's a scary thing when you don't know them. And the only way, I believe, to learn a language is to have no option. So I threw myself into it, and I learned to speak German by listening to music or listening to TV shows. The Rolling Stones record we've just played, or the Start Me Up, was the resolution of a long-standing sort of argument I'd had with myself about from when I was very young. You know, who was better, the Beatles or Elvis? Well, it turned out to be the Stones. I think they're probably, arguably, the greatest rock band ever. And I've seen them a couple of times. I accidentally walked into a Rolling Stones concert in 1969 in Hyde Park in London, when Brian Jones was still alive. And I was very far away, and I didn't really know what was going on. Obviously, I could hear the music, and I knew who it was. But I was still a schoolboy and completely, you know, blown away by it. But I saw them later on. I can't quite remember where. It might have been in Madrid.
Yeah.
They're a great band. That's and always a fantastic concert.
And while you were abroad, did you go to any classical music concerts? Because I see you've chosen some Beethoven and some Tárrega.
I didn't go out of my way to listen to any classical music. I'd rather grown up with it. But Bonn, of course, was where Beethoven lived, and his house has been beautifully maintained, as could only happen in Germany. And it just reminded me, when I was doing the list, you know, I'd sort of hum things to myself and bits of symphonies or music that you like. You know, if I played them to my kids, they'd recognize the advert it came from. But it's found, I discovered that so on balance, most of the things that I like to hum to myself sometimes were written by Ludwig van Beethoven. So I thought, we could put a couple of them together if you were able to do that. It would be great. I mean, the choral version of his Ode to Joy, which is the Ninth Symphony, I think it's the
that's correct
fourth movement. I think Bernstein has conducted the Berlin Philharmonic playing that, but he that and the it's a wonderful slow dirge almost in the Seventh Symphony, the second movement. And I know them in my brain, and they're just planted there, you know. And every time I want to find them, I struggle. And I have to sort of call people and ask and then hum things over the telephone and say, where do I find this again? Where do I find this? So he's just part of, somehow Beethoven is part of my story. In an oblique sort of way, partly because I've been to his house, I suppose,
yeah,
and partly because some of the things he wrote, some of the music he wrote is just achingly beautiful.
Well, I've found the final section of the Ninth Symphony, from where the choir sing the big tune, and that's what we're going to hear now. It's Leonard Bernstein, and it's recorded in Berlin. It's a section of the final movement of the Ninth Symphony. That was Leonard Bernstein performing with a group in Berlin, probably the Berlin Philharmonic, and it was part of the famous Ninth Symphony, the Ode to Joy, which also forms the European Union national anthem.
A very optimistic song for a German poet.
Yes. Schiller's Ode to Joy. What a great piece, though. We performed it, funny enough, the last piece that I performed before lockdown was the Ninth Symphony.
Really?
And I almost feel it should be the first piece we perform when we open up again.
Yeah. Alle Menschen werden brüden.
Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful piece. Very stirring. And it resonates with the Germans. They perform it, you know, regularly every year. And in Japan, it's like Handel's Messiah. They perform it regularly there too.
Yeah.
Now, you're a sort of, in a way, you're a disruptor. This is a sort of new term for people, a disruptor. Do you see yourself as a disruptor?
Well, I try not to, you know, I don't like being told what to do. And I don't like fitting in. I never have. And I don't like, really, I'm not a team player. So I've always struggled with authority. So I don't, you know, disruptors tend to be regarded as people who have done something meritorious and have given the world a new way of looking at things. And I don't know that I've been able to do that. I mean, I've tried my hardest when I was a newspaper editor to fight off the forces of simplification and cost cutting and degradation of a craft that I hold very dear to my heart. And it was awful working with managers who didn't care.
Yeah.
Shareholders who didn't care. And for as long as I was the editor of Business Day, I'm satisfied, reasonably satisfied, that I produced a newspaper that you could land in Johannesburg from London or New York or wherever from and pick it up and say, hey, this is a serious country.
Yeah.
And that's why I got up and went to work every morning for those 14 years. I loved it. I mean, it's the best job I've ever had. And it was an absolute privilege to be the editor of Business Day and of the Financial Mail.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I'm a disruptor. I'm just badly behaved.
Because one of the things you said in one of your emails to me was that you sort of felt instinctively drawn to the Spaniards because of their anarchism and romanticism.
Yeah. No, they're complete anarchists. I mean, just a little brief anecdote. When they joined the EU, so this is after Franco dies, they joined the EU, and gradually you get more and more integrated, you know, when you join the European Union. And came the moment when they had to have their cars regularly roadworthied. And almost instantly, an industry grew up where you could rent parts for your cars for the roadworthy test and then give them back once you passed the roadworthy, and they'd put your old parts back on, your brake pads that didn't work and whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And they are just, you know, they're just lovely, the Spanish. I mean, if South Africans could speak Spanish, they'd see a lot of themselves in it, in them. I felt very at home in Madrid, and I could live there again tomorrow in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
The country itself was fantastic. The wine was lovely. The sea, the Mediterranean is still the best piece of ocean, I think, on the planet. Lovely and warm. No waves, you know, it just swirls around you. It's gorgeous. So yeah. I love the Spaniards, and I love their approach to life. You know, I mean, the siesta was still very much a thing in those days. And so if we were writing, I was writing for the Financial Times from there. So we had an hour, we were an hour ahead. And our lunches would last then from about 1 o'clock until 5 o'clock. So by the time you got back at 5 o'clock, you weren't in any state to produce, anything particularly thoughtful. And fortunately, the Spaniards seemed to get their news out of the way early and in the day, so I never got found out.
Well, here are some memories of the Alhambra. This is music by Andres Targa, played by Paco de Lucia. That was Recuerdos de la Alhambra by Andres Targa. The guitarist was Paco de Lucia, and that was chosen by Peter Bruce, who's my guest in People of Note.
Just a quick thing about the Alhambra. As you leave Granada, to go down to the coast, you go up a hill, and you pass a sign saying with the name "El último respiro del Moro," the Moor's last sigh, and it was in recognition of the fact that when the Moors were chased out of Spain by the Christians, the Catholics, they turned at this particular spot to look down at Granada, the capital, and the palace that that they had built, and wept it, you know, shed a tear, and then moved. And we forget, you know, in how wonderfully those civilizations existed back in the 10th, 11th, 12th, 9th centuries.
Yeah.
The Moors ruled Spain for 700 years. And they did it with the Jews, as a unit, you know, as a team. The Moors owned the place and the Jews ran it or administered it, which is quite extraordinary. Yeah. And it, to look at Arab and Jewish relations now, you'd think that had never happened, but it just reminds you that you're sort of just, we're just a blot in time, you know.
Yeah, and of course, they both of those groups left their imprint on the music of Spain, and yeah, certainly on the architecture, which has fantastic Moorish elements to it. Yeah,
Paco de Lucía, I don't know, for me, is the greatest guitarist ever. I mean, I never saw him play, but to be able to do what he can do with his fingers and hands,
yeah,
is just amazing, indescribably good.
And now we're coming a little more up to date with your next choice of music, which is Wynton Marsalis and Eric Clapton, and this was to do with that redoubtable lady Molly Blackburn.
Well, in tangentially, so I married a second time to Robin Chalmers, whose mother, Judy Chalmers, grew up in Port Elizabeth and was Molly Blackburn's sister and was in the same car with Molly when Molly's fatal accident and unexplained accident occurred. As you know, she was a fierce activist in the Black Sash, along with Judy, at the time, the late 80s. And I think Molly's funeral in PE is still the biggest funeral in that town has ever had. I see pictures of it every now and again. There must have been 100,000 people there, almost entirely come in from the townships in honor of the work that she, appreciation of the work that she had tried to do. So we see a lot of Judy, who's a wonderful woman. And she came up to Johannesburg a couple of years ago, and I tried to sort of put some music together, thinking that I should play, you know, should put together a playlist for an older lady. And she surprised me by being entirely bored with what I was playing her and said, "Do you have any Wynton Marsalis?" I said, "I'd never heard of him. What does he do?" So she directed me to this particular song. And I didn't know what it was for the first few minutes because I'm a real Clapton fan. And it took it a while for it to resolve into something that I recognized it. But it was a great collaboration, and I owe it all to Judy Chalmers.
Here it is, Layla, Wynton Marsalis, and Eric Clapton. That was Layla, featuring Wynton Marsalis and Eric Clapton. Like you, Peter, although I didn't stay away as long as you did, I was away for 8 years. But I must say that after 8 years, I was 100% ready to come back home. I really missed South Africa. And I think you probably suffered some of those same pangs, because I get the feeling that you're a sort of a deep South African. You love this place.
Absolutely. I can't not live here. You know, I cannot imagine. I think about it sometimes because I've got a lot of friends. I've spent 20 years out of the country, and I've got friends that I miss in Germany, in Spain, in the UK. But I can't really imagine ever living there again, in any serious and permanent way. You know, I mean, it's nice to visit. And I'm moved. You know, South Africa is such a disaster. And at the same time, it's so uplifting. I mean, people here are so brave and courageous and strong. We're 100 years behind the rest of the world, maybe 200 years behind the rest of the world still. Some of our people are living medieval lives. And watching them rise and watching the possibility of success and prosperity play out and then disappear and play out again and then vanish again is completely sort of, I'm transfixed by it. I cannot not be here.
Yeah. Well, facing every day is like a sort of challenge for many people.
It's too terrible. And it's very hard to explain South Africa to a visitor who comes here. particularly if they're of a sensitive nature. Because you get asked how you can live here. You know, I drove from Stanford to Somerset West yesterday, past the most disgraceful urbanizations, if you wanted to call them, you know, tin shacks, and near Krobo, and then down at the bottom of Solari's Pass again. And we've got to fix it somehow, you know. We need to make sure that we hold the government of the day, whatever it may be, to account so that they fix it. And sadly, what we have is a system now where there's only one party in contention to run the country. And it doesn't doing a very good job of it at all.
Yeah.
It is at war with itself, and it's almost at war with its own people. And, it won't last forever. And something else will happen to break the hold, that it has, but it's not in prospect anytime soon.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Well, one of the areas that you must have passed quite close to on your way to Cape Town was Manenberg, and that's your next choice with, as he was then, Dollar Brand. That was the famous recording by Dollar Brand, as he then was, Abdullah Ibrahim of Manenberg, the choice of Peter Bruce, who's my guest in People of Note. Peter was editor of newspapers. He was a reporter in Europe and ended up here with the Business Day financial newspaper. And you also had other causes that you sort of supported, because where I first came across you, I think, was when you were looking after, well, not looking after, but the annual business and arts awards were done with Business Day as a media partner. And I remember meeting you there. Yeah, Barca.
Yeah, and that was, once again, something that, you know, we're forced to walk away from because we weren't making enough money out of it. And we weren't losing any money. But managers who, you know, get tired of these things simply say eventually, well, no, you know, we made R1 million out of the business and the arts supplement last year. We're only making 600,000 now. It's not worth it. And, you know, you don't win every battle.
Yeah.
And you know, I love the Barca Awards. I mean, because they were great. They got companies involved, and it was a night of companies sort of, you know, showing off the things that they were doing in their communities or for communities. And it was terrific. And we used to have lovely events and lovely evenings and very good for Business Day. And
very good for the arts too.
Well, this is the point. I mean, and you know, I don't know what has happened, but these things only happen because people fight for them to happen. You know, Michelle Constant and I kept that thing alive for 10 years.
Yeah.
Or kept that partnership alive for 10 years. And it's just exhausting.
Yeah.
Because the people who are given ownership, who are able to afford to buy newspaper companies, tend not to be publishers. They don't have it in their hearts. They're just another business that, you know, you can squeeze a few bucks out of. It makes me so cross to think about it. I worked for a long time for the Financial Times, and it was run by a company called Pearson. And Pearson PLC was the most wonderful owner. There was a time in the 1980s where there was a strike at the FT, and it was caused over a wage negotiation that Pearson had botched. And the strike went on for a long time. It was about 2 months, which is a long time for a daily newspaper to be off the streets. And on the day that the paper came back, the presses broke. So we were only able to produce half the number of papers that we were normally able to produce. And in the paper, there was an article very critical of Pearson. And they were so committed to the newspaper and freedom of speech that they ordered for the next day an even bigger newspaper that would be able to reprint the article that a lot of people hadn't got to see the day before, which was very critical of them. And I can't imagine anybody who owns a newspaper in South Africa now doing the same thing.
Yeah. Well, your second to last choice is Leonard Cohen. And this, I mean, he died a couple of years ago, and we certainly paid tribute to him in several concerts. Very special performer.
Yeah. I saw him very close up in Madrid, and easily the sexiest man alive. I just adored Leonard Cohen. And I think, it was just a terrible loss. His songs were thoughtful and there was a bit of, I'm sure, poetic trickery in them. And he knew how to, tug a heartstring.
Yeah.
But he had a lovely manner about him and he would dress. I remember he was dressed when I saw him, he was thin as a rake and he had a black t-shirt on and a gray suit. And I just wish I could carry that off. It was just a fascinating and a lovely, lovely concert, a lovely, lovely time, that evening. I'll never forget it. And Robin and I go to Hydra in Greece, every year, where we have been up until, the coronavirus got in the way. But, Hydra was where he lived with the famous Marianne, his Norwegian lover, to whom he sang "So Long, Marianne" eventually. And the house, they're still in the Cohen family, still up there. And I make every now and again a pilgrimage up the hill. It's quite a steep climb to get to it. It's my little homage to Leonard Cohen. If I had to take one singer with me to a desert island, it would be his music.
Well, and you've chosen Anthem. This was from a live concert in London. It's Leonard Cohen. That was Leonard Cohen, Anthem, from a concert called Live in London, the choice of Peter Bruce. And we're fast coming towards the end of the program now, and we've got one more choice of music, which is from the soundtrack of Cry Freedom, which is the film about your brother-in-law, Donald Woods, and his relationship with Steve Biko. And when you emailed me, you said that this was when you heard, this song and saw the movie, you knew you'd be coming home.
Yeah.
And it's a very powerful song. It's Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, which has become our national anthem in combination with the old Die Stem.
Yeah.
A sort of medley of two tunes, but it remains a very, very powerful song.
Yeah, this is the pure version of Nkosi Sikelel'. There's no English or Afrikaans in it, and it's topped and tailed by some of the most haunting sounds. We forget, that Cry Freedom won an Oscar for this soundtrack. And it's easily the best version of Nkosi Sikelel' ever, in my view. And if you talk to me afterwards, I shall probably be in tears. So give me a moment when you're finished.
Yeah. Well, we're going to play out with that, actually. So you won't have to have your tears on air.
The making of the movie, I wasn't part of it, but I heard all about it as it was going along. And Donald and Wendy and I were at the funeral in King Williamstown after Steve died. And it was the most incredible awakening for me to watch how people could lose something as precious as he was and behave themselves with as much grace and dignity as that crowd did. It was quite a remarkable experience. And there weren't many white people in the stadium. And the police stopped a lot of people, a lot of buses from getting there, but it was full nonetheless. But it was an event of just staggering anguish and beauty and meaning.
That was from the soundtrack of the film Cry Freedom, called The Funeral. And that's where, sadly, we have to end this interview. It's been a fantastic 2 hours that we've spent with Peter Bruce. And I just want to say thank you, Peter, for sharing your time with us and telling us what you've told us. Strong messages about people choosing careers and fighting for what they believe in and enjoying life while you do it. So thank you very much indeed for that. And we look forward to hearing more from Stanford in the Western Cape in due course. But many thanks.
You will. Thank you for making me do this. It really made me think about my life a little bit, and that's no bad thing. We forget what our great reward is, you know, and that's just simply to be alive.
And that's where we must end, People of Note, tonight. We thank you at home for listening. And if you want to hear this on a podcast, then you just go anytime you want to the Classic 1027 website, www.classic1027.co.za, and just follow the prompts. But from all of us here at Classic 1027 and from Peter Bruce in the Western Cape, we say thanks for listening, and until next time, from all of us, a very good night.